Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Well, it's an annual race to the finish line at the state capitol. What began as more than 2,500 bills was whittled down to hundreds passed by state lawmakers, now awaiting their fate of being signed into law or vetoed at the governor's desk. The 9 months of negotiating and amendments came to a close at last week's end of session, and CAP Radio politics reporter Nicole Nixon was in the thick of it, making sense of the legislative frenzy up until the final moments. Nicole joins us with the big theme lawmakers debated this year and some of the more significant bills that may become new state laws. Good morning, Nicole.
Good morning.
Okay, so since a legislative session in California is 2 years, why was last week the end of session?
Yeah, it is a 2-year session. It's a bit like Congress, but they break it up into 1-year chunks. So last December, they started introducing bills. Those kind of take 9 months, like a little baby, to make it through the session. What that means, though, is any bills that did not make it to that midnight deadline do have a chance to come back next year. It's kind of like an easy revival process. They can become what's known as a 2-year bill. So we may see some of these that didn't make it again next year.
So you mentioned there's 9 months to this. Why is it always so crazy in the final days of session?
Maybe we should ask the lawmakers that, because I would also love to know. But the legislature does have deadlines kind of throughout the 9 months. And I would say in the first few months of the session, they're very focused on crafting and passing a state budget. So that takes up a lot of the energy the first 4 or 5 months. And then after June, they really focus on all of these policy bills. So, you know, they'll hear them and debate them kind of on the side while they're doing the state budget, get them to the other house. After the budget is signed into law at the end of June, then they'll really focus on the policy bills and get really into the nitty gritty on a lot of these. That's when you see a lot of the more fierce debate.
You know, given that you're writing this out, too, as a reporter, you know, at the state capitol, what was last week like as a journalist? I don't think you got much sleep.
It was a bit of a blur. last week was actually there was one surprise, and that was that they ended right before midnight. So luckily we weren't waiting around until, you know, the very last minute. Sometimes they can go past midnight in certain situations. Last year, I think they were passing bills until after 2 a.m. because they had urgency clauses, and that is allowed. So I would say last year was maybe a bit more crazy.
And what starts off as a bill like come January can look very different, you know, last week. You know, it goes through a lot of, you know, legislative hurdles, like kind of like a bill 101. Walk us through a bill's like kind of journey, which is far from straightforward to becoming a state law, potentially.
Yeah. So let's take a bill that originates in the assembly. A lawmaker is an assembly member representing a certain area. They can introduce a bill because they are an assembly member. It starts in an assembly committee hearing. If it passes that, depending on if it costs money, it might go to the appropriations committee. That's a whole process where the bills pile up and they do a big hearing to send them to the floor all at once. If it passes the floor, then it will go to the Senate and get the same treatment on the in the other chamber. I think this is where you see a lot of the bills actually die in the second half of the session when they're in the other kind of the other chamber, and the lawmakers over there are less invested. They're not their like working colleagues' bills, so they may be more likely to shelve something or not put it through. So this is where you gotta have a lot of the negotiating as lawmakers. And then if it is changed in the other chamber, it has to go back to a chamber of origin. So this is what we call concurrence votes. And many times if it passes the other chamber, you may hear it's got to go back to the assembly for a procedural vote. That just means it's got to have concurrence. One thing about the California legislature and other state legislatures is they'll do a lot of gut and amend bills is what we call them. So if a bill, kind of a technical a piece of legislation goes through the first chamber and there's a some like big emergency or a lawmaker decides they want to change it, they can gut and amend that bill, basically change the entire meaning, put it in something entirely new. And I think this is where a lot of the like big kind of surprise last minute legislation comes in. And we had some of those this year. There was a bill to give workers on strike unemployment benefits. That was a gut and amend bill. They're really like the kind of the hot pieces of legislation you get at the very end.
Mm. And if it does get to that finish line, and say if the governor vetoes a bill, that's not always the end result, right? The legislature can also step in and kind of go against that veto if they have like 2/3 of a vote. It's rare, but...
It is very rare. But yeah, in California and a lot of other state legislatures, the legislature can do a veto override if they have 2/3. But I think that, you know, the Democratic supermajority and Governor Gavin Newsom are in lockstep on a lot of things. So it's been pretty rare here.
So I mentioned there were like over 2,500 bills passed this year, or introduced this year. Where does that stack up to prior years? It sounds like a lot.
Yeah, there's a longtime lobbyist named Chris McKaylee, who is like, I have to shout him out because it sends these like statistics. It's like a sports show. So thank you, Chris. I got an email from him that says this year over 1,100 bills were sent to the governor's desk. So about 2,500 introduced. Not quite half were sent to the governor's desk. He's already signed 200 of that. That includes a big budget package in June. And then he's been signing some, you know, in the days and past few weeks.
Mm. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with CAP Radio politics reporter Nicole Nixon about the bills passed by state lawmakers awaiting the governor's signature or veto. So what were the big themes for this year?
I have to say that labor was a really big story the last week or two of the legislative session. I mentioned the bill on unemployment for workers on strike. That one might be a tough one for the governor to decide on because California's unemployment fund is over $18 billion in debt. If you remember during the pandemic, it was a huge target for fraud, and they're still working to pay that off. The governor said that he received a letter from the unemployment agency, EDD, that the debt could grow and be $20 billion in 5 years, I believe. So lawmakers, you know, they wanted a big win with labor. They passed that one. Could be a hard decision for the governor. Other labor bills, there will be, if Newsom signs them, new industry minimum wages for fast food workers, could get $20 an hour minimum wage, and then healthcare workers. This could take a few years to get all the way to $25 an hour, but that's the goal, $25 an hour for all healthcare workers by 2028. And then the legislature, this was a big one for them. They voted finally, after years and years and years of attempts to do this, to allow their own staff to unionize. And this has been a big topic. I think this is the fifth attempt in as many years, maybe. And for a legislature that is as pro-labor as this one, I think staff really feel that it was hypocritical that they've been trying for so long to get the right to collectively bargain. And if the governor signs this bill, they will have that beginning in 2026.
Hmm. You spoke with Senate Pro Tempore Toni Atkins. What did she have to say?
Yeah, she did talk about some of these labor bills. And I guess let's just hear from her.
You know, you consider the economy that we're living in, you consider what we've been through this last 3 years, I think workers and employees have really felt like they need more support and more help. And then you think about, you know, taking care of your families, I think that resonated. And while the bills are still not easy, there's an economic impact, and we have to make sure we can pay for these things. And clearly, you know, these bills are on the way to the governor's desk. That's the next step. But I think a lot of work went into this, and I feel good. It's a balancing act. It's supporting workers and labor, as well as businesses and the economy in California. And we have to balance it and do it all.
That was Senate Pro Tem Toni Atkins right after both chambers had adjourned on the final night of the session, talking about the labor bills and kind of the push to get those across the finish line. this year.
Mm. You know, it's also a more diverse legislature. There are a lot of new faces. I mean, did that lead to some surprises as you're following these bills, you know, throughout this year?
Yeah, I have to say, on the bill to allow legislative staff to unionize, the author, Assemblymember Tina McKinner, she is a former staffer. She worked in the building for years, and she directly credited the new legislature, this wave of new lawmakers that came in earlier this year because of redistricting and people, other former lawmakers leaving due to term limits. She says this is a more progressive chamber, and they're younger, they're more diverse, and she credited that new assembly for getting this bill across.
A big challenge for California this year are insurance companies that are moving out of state. You know, State Farm and Allstate were the two biggest ones. You know, the legislature did try to remedy this. What was the end result?
The end result was it didn't come together. I think there was a rush. There were talks and discussions. There were select work groups of lawmakers trying to get a deal together with insurance companies, and it fell apart in the last few days. Now, this is something that lawmakers have said they'll work on over the interim. There will be hearings in the assembly. But Governor Gavin Newsom has said he can't wait. This is such an urgent issue that he wants to act sooner. So I guess we'll have to see what the governor can come up with without lawmakers. Also asked the new Assembly Speaker Robert Rivas about this issue. So here's him on the final night.
You know, we wanted an ironclad guarantee that consumers were going to be, you know, sure that they were protected in any type of, legislative effort.
Hmm. You know, given that we only have a few minutes left, I mean, what bills, if signed into law? I mean, you mentioned there's like over 1,000. Which ones stand out to you as having potentially the most widespread impact?
There were a few bills to build affordable housing. This is a perennial issue, obviously, in California, and everybody feels that. I know lawmakers are hoping that a couple of the bills, one would allow make it easier for religious institutions and nonprofits to build affordable housing, opening up potentially over 100,000 or more new units, and then streamlining and codifying some affordable housing rules that we're about to sunset. The one that I think will have an impact on a lot of, again, workers working minimum wage, is the state raise the amount of required sick time from 3 days that employers must provide to 5. And then there was a bill, they called this the Skittles bill. Yeah. It would ban some toxic food additives. However, I have to say, there were 5 originally. The one in Skittles, titanium dioxide, was removed. So I guess we can't call it the Skittles bill anymore. But the red dye number 3 and some brominated vegetable oils, mm-hmm. You can find the list at kepradio.org.
Yeah, as we know, you know, at the state capitol, it's a Democrat, super majority. Were there any wins for Republicans?
There was. I have to say, the Republican caucus tried many times to raise criminal penalties. I think that was a big priority for them fentanyl was a big one. We've talked about that, Vicky. Retail theft. They had a big win with Senate Bill 14, which would make child trafficking a strikeable offense, basically meaning that if you do it multiple times, you can automatically get a 25-year to life sentence. It's the first time in decades that a crime has been added to the 3 strikes law. So a huge win for Republicans there. And I think we'll see them probably try to do that strategy in future years.
A lot of bills for you to follow to see how the governor decides.
He has 1 month to decide what to sign or veto. So, yeah, we'll keep our eyes on that. And he announced in New York that he would sign a bill to require billion-dollar companies to disclose their greenhouse gas emissions. So another California leading on environmental policy is what he said there.
That is Cap Radio politics reporter Nicole Nixon discussing this year's end of the legislative session and the hundreds of bills passed by state lawmakers awaiting the governor's signature or veto. You're listening to Insight. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. This week, a major new addition at UC Davis will be unveiled to the public. The newly expanded Gorman Museum of Native American Art is one of only a small number of museums in the United States that is focused on telling the story of Native Americans through art. Along with a grand opening ceremony, there will be music, dance, and other performances, along with works by 20 artists who are all members of California tribes. Joining us are museum curator Veronica Pasalacqua and Gorman Museum director Halia Sinajini. Welcome to you both. Good morning. Thanks for joining us. A big week.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Halia, I want to start with you. This is such a big deal, not only for the campus of UC Davis, but also the community, for visitors, and of course, Native American and Indigenous artists. Explain the importance and the significance of this new gallery, the expansion.
Well, of course, the Gorman started from humble beginnings, and but it's always been strong in what we like to term visual sovereignty. And visual sovereignty is basically taking control of one's own image. And that's the very important part of the Gorman Museum, in that artists are free to express themselves and to explain themselves rather than being interpreted by someone who has no idea about their tribe or where they come from.
How long?
So that's very strong.
How long have you been part of the museum?
Since 2004.
So nearly 20 years. That is a long journey.
It is a long journey, but a really beautiful one though.
Veronica, the museum is 50 years old. I believe this year is the 50th anniversary. How long has this expansion been in the works? Because it's going to be four times the size, or it is four times the size of what it originally started as.
Indeed. The gallery space, well, it's been in the works for quite some time. I, too, joined the museum in 2004, so we'll both be coming up on 20 years. And pretty much from the beginning, we had our eyes on a larger space. But really, it was 10 years ago at our 40th anniversary party that donors and sponsors really started pushing the university leadership to help us to get to this place where we are now. And the, you know, with COVID and everything, we've been under construction and planning for a solid 5 years, really, to get the build. The expansion, you're absolutely right. The gallery space is about four times as large. The whole building, though, is about 11,000 square feet. So it was really exciting that not only do we have space to present more works and more galleries, but that we could move all the collections and everything we have into the building. So that was exciting.
Given that you both have been working and collaborating in tandem since 2004, and this week is a really big moment, how does it feel to kind of know that you've already taken it in, but knowing that this is like a long overdue chapter for people who are going to be excited and taking in the grand opening ceremony this weekend? How does it feel?
Exhausting, but exciting.
A good exhausting, right?
And we are so excited because, just being able to show these shows in with contemporary work, with the collections, and having it really being able to expand our narrative on what we're able to share with our visitors. And we're going to have a shop as well that we're very excited about. And, you know, we're partnering with the Arboretum on the campus, and we even have parking. So all of this is a very exciting time.
Halea, what are you looking forward to most? Do you have some favorite parts and pieces of this new museum?
Well, of course, the space, the expansion allows us to do a couple of things. We have a permanent collection exhibition on that one can go through. Then the other part is a changing exhibition. And of course, the exhibitions really inform the students on campus. But I guess what I'm really excited about is that we have created a museum presence for Native American artists in a tier one university at UC Davis. And there are not very many museums that are collaborate with a university. Which ones? University of Oklahoma, Institute of American Indian Arts, but utilizing the museum as a teaching tool.
And some people might not even know, Halea, that UC Davis, it sits on the land that was home of the Patwin people. Can you explain a little bit more about the Patwin and the connection with the campus?
The Patwin people, which means outside people, the Patwin land is surrounded by three of the nations, which is Yochidehi, Kletzel, and Kachil. And the thing is that we have a land acknowledgement, which we have very prominent on the outside and the inside of the museum. And if when visiting UC Davis, which sits on the Wintun Patwin land, if you're not Patwin, if you're not Wintun, you're a visitor. I'm a visitor. Veronica's a visitor. Yeah, and so to pay homage to you know, that idea, that is why we are having a California Native exhibition first, paying respect to our host.
Halea, how long has art been a part of your life? I mean, you've obviously been at the museum since 2004, but when did it start for you personally?
It's been part of my life all my life. My father was a painter in the Southwest. And so I was around brushes and the smell of paint ever since I was little. And then I thought I was going to become a painter, but I became a photographer. And then I decided I needed security, and I became a professor and a director.
And still connected with art, obviously, as a curator of this museum. How about you, Veronica? When did art become a part of your life?
Oh, goodness. I think it was really my undergraduate years when I started studying non-Western art and Native American art. And it really, over the years, it really focused into contemporary work. And I absolutely love working with living artists. So even though quite often when you're in school, you study all of this historical material, which is so important, but it's one of the things the Gorman does and that we've been doing for the last 20 years is being able to show work with living artists and bringing those people to campus, which was always the mission of the Gorman from its first day. And in fact, its first exhibition back in 1973 was California Native artists. So we're really excited to have this kind of a larger survey show.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Gorman Museum curator Veronica Pasalacqua and professor of Native American Studies and museum director Halea Sinajini about the big grand opening of the newly expanded Gorman Museum of Native American Art on the campus of UC Davis. Okay, Veronica, let's get into the art and the artists. If someone is going to be going to the Gorman this weekend for the first time, what can they expect? If you can give us a little bit of a visual tour.
Well, first when they arrive, certainly from Saturday, for our big party day, they're going to be met with all kinds of things outside the building before they even get inside. So we're really excited to have a huge festival kind of thing with that includes artist vendors and artist-led activities. So we have five California Native artists that our visitors can sit down and create with and make things. So Saturday is going to be a big day. When you come in the museum, the shop will have a number of very contemporary, fun, Native sourced material. So there's all kinds of things in there. So, and we're building that. So that's exciting. And then of course you walk in the museum and the first thing you'll see is the contemporary Native American show, California Native American show. And we have, as you mentioned earlier, about 20 artists in that exhibition with pieces that are in the collection or on loan from the artists or on loan from some private collections. And there's several really important artists in that show. So you might know Frank LaPenna's work from your campus there. And we're really pleased to be showing a beautiful painting of his that's a future gift to the museum. We have some pieces by Harry Fonseca, who's Maidu and Nisenan. And we have a very prominent piece by Judy Lowry. So that's just a few of the pieces that you'll encounter. And there's some surprises. So that's what, when we're putting together shows, we really like to surprise our visitors so that we kind of expand their worldview about what Native art is. So, there's some exciting things. Yeah.
Given that this museum has been around for 50 years, you've been part of the museum for nearly 20 years, how has the broader museum community's interest in Native American art, history, and culture, how has it evolved throughout that time?
Well, there's been a lot of changes in the last 20 years. And that, I think, is a part of BLM, a part of land acknowledgement. A lot of political climates have changed to be more supportive of Native American perspectives and worldview. And so we've come right along with that. I mean, and that is part of why we got this new museum as well, is that recognition. And the wider museum world has started showing more contemporary, well, more Native American art, sometimes contemporary. But the difficult thing with that, so it's fantastic to get pieces out there, but the challenging part is how that work is interpreted. Because in those institutions, in a lot of these larger museums, they may not really know what they're showing. So that's where it's exciting. Where we're at is that, you know, we have an academic background and a specialty in this area to really help convey the artist's message and really an artist-based exhibition approach. So instead of having curatorial statements, you'll hear directly from artists about what they think about their work and how they interpret their work, which of course is more important than what we think.
Yeah. Halea, I mean, given that you have a background in art, you're also on the academic arm as well as a professor. Why is it important to share this art with the world and in the way that Veronica just described? What message does it send?
Well, there's different levels because I utilize the art to teach my graduate students that they don't need to always transfer their knowledge or their ideas textually, but visually, and that can also have a very strong impact. For the outside community from campus, it's, again, like Veronica was saying, showing that Native American art is what they never thought of, and that,
There are issues. It can be political. It can be about beauty. It can be about, you know, feelings about land. And so it's, yeah, it varies. It will dispel the tropes and the stereotypes that people have about Native American art.
Well, Julia and Veronica, thank you for all of the work and congratulations for what is a really big milestone for the Gorman Museum of Native American Art.
Thank you.
But we do want to give out a plug to make sure people come on Saturday.
Yep. Saturday is the big day. Thank you so much. You're listening to Insight. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. For nearly 100 years, the Stockton Symphony has been a melodic constant in San Joaquin County, among the oldest continuously operating professional orchestras in California. And at the heart are the people behind the music. Earlier this year, the symphony faced heartbreak after their CEO, Philip West, unexpectedly passed away. We talked with the Stockton Symphony during that time to honor Philip. But now, the symphony is starting its 97th season with a new chapter in leadership. Music director and conductor Peter Jaffe joins us ahead of the season opener, which kicks off this weekend, and we welcome the new CEO of the Stockton Symphony, Scott Watkins. Good morning. Welcome to you both.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for having us here.
And I know we're going to be looking forward, but if listeners are just learning of this, remind us of Philip West's legacy on the Stockton Symphony.
We worked together actually twice. He was our ED, our executive director, from 2003 to 2007. And then after spending almost a decade with the Memphis Ballet, he came back to the Stockton Symphony, and we had a wonderful partnership rekindling that wonderful business and personal relationship. It was great working with Philip, and he helped us devise so many great new programs, even during the pandemic, where we would have a little small ensemble go visit a donor on their front lawn or something like that. And we've continued those small ensemble programs where we visit Boys and Girls Clubs and things like that to this day. And so it was very sad and unexpected that it was just a minor operation that he went in for at the end of last February, and it just went south. Mm-hmm. And it was very tragic, and we all mourned his loss. We were so grateful to you, Vicky, for reaching out and bringing us and on the station and doing that memorial tribute. In the past 6 months, it's been absolutely amazing. The staff really rallied. We all took on a little bit more duties to fill in while we were mounting the search. And we had a very good end to the season. We dedicated a few concerts to Philip. And we ran a very extensive search. And it's so wonderful to be able to introduce our new CEO, the result of that search, Mr. Scott Watkins. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to bring him here to meet you and to meet our whole Cap Radio audience.
Before we get to Scott, what stood out about Scott?
You know, first of all, he has some amazing achievements with other orchestras he's led, and he's been in the orchestra business for many years. But his personality is also fantastic. He just knows that one of the most important things in our business is developing relationships, and he really hit all those marks.
So, Scott, I believe you're coming from out of state, correct? Landing here at the Stockton Symphony. What stood out about the Stockton Symphony?
Well, the Stockton Symphony has such great quality of musicians. That's unusual. I mean, a lot of other locations, you're really hurting in some areas. And here you have so much talent and so much ability in the Bay Area that you can draw on and provide this high quality music for people to listen to.
Well, tell us a little bit about yourself and your journey.
Sure.
Throughout professional orchestras.
Well, my journey started when I was in the fourth grade.
way back.
That's right. I was a budding musician. I wanted to be a musician. My dad took me to look at instruments and to pick one out. And so I was gravitating to the percussion area. You know, I was really interested in that and banging on things. And he looked at the price tag and immediately turned me around and showed me what a clarinet looked like. A little bit less expensive and probably easier on the ear for him, at least, as I started out on my music training. But so I became a clarinetist and got pretty good at it. And had wonderful experiences at universities and training and with performing with many different orchestras and wind bands. And so eventually ended up in my training at the University of North Texas. And my wife and I had 5 children, and we decided that we probably needed insurance. And that's when I started working at the Dallas Symphony so that I could help provide for the family. And that kicked off really my administrative career. I never thought I was going to go that direction, but ended up doing that. But music is still in my blood. I still play. And my wife is a vocalist, and we love music. It's in our home all the time.
Well, Peter, that brings me to, you know, the season opener, you know, for 2023, 2024. How was it working together on this?
Well, we already had it designed before we brought Scott on board, but I know he loves it, the idea that we're going to do. First of all, we really want to always hook in with how we connect with our audiences. And so we're actually having a party 1 hour before each actual performance time. So, for instance, we're running 2 performances this weekend on the 23rd at 7:30. So that means the party starts at 6:30. Or on Sunday at 2:30, which means the party starts on the patio at 1:30. Each time we're going to have the Cesar Chavez High School Jazz Band playing out on the patio. We'll have refreshments and a great kind of gathering of the crowd. And then when we get inside, we've got a program that's kind of compact variety. We're starting with Brazil, and I don't know if we have time to play a little.
Yeah, Barroso. Clip. Well, we can play a little
Ari clip. Barroso. Okay.
You can go ahead and set us up.
Why don't we give just a little. This has become almost like the unofficial national anthem of Brazil. Mm-hmm. This song is so famous. Kudos. If you hear this in the radio audience and you recognize it, you get 1 brownie point.
Not feel good listening to that.
Yeah, we're really hoping it'll tap everybody's toes. The next piece on this program, we don't have a clip for because there's no way to actually duplicate it in the radio audience. But you know how in live performances, we're always concerned about our cell phones. We want to make sure not to make a faux pas. This concert is probably going to be the first and perhaps last time when we insist that everybody in the audience have their cell phones on. Because we're going to have a sound clip that lasts just about a minute for this piece. The total piece length is around 12 minutes, but it was written by a Chinese-American composer named Tan Dun. It's called Passacaglia, Song of Wind and Birds. And there's a little 1-minute clip that we'll have available by a link or by a QR code. And, you know, people will get it in an email blast beforehand, or we'll have the QR code there at their performance. So there's a certain point in the piece when we want everybody in the audience to actually have this clip on their cell phone and play it live. And it's not that's supposed to be synchronized. So if everybody's a split second off or so and it's kind of phased, that's on purpose. It'll be kind of like a really elegant jungle of sounds of ancient Chinese instruments and birds.
Yeah, that's wonderful, adding some interactivity with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a wonderful kind of artistic device and a really new age way to hook in with. I mean, everybody's engrossed in their phones, right? And so instead of it being a taboo, we're saying, hey, you get to use it. The next piece on the program is the piano concerto by Maurice Ravel, and we've got a wonderful piano soloist, Stanislav Krishtenko, who's actually Ukrainian in heritage, and just hearing his life story is so heartwarming. You know, he's still got family over there, but he's actually playing the third time in Stockton. He's become like a local favorite, and he's a Cleveland competition winner. I mean, he's got an international career going. And he's playing this lovely concerto by Ravel, which actually is infused even with a little bit of jazz elements, crossover with Gershwin.
Yeah. Let's take a listen. I love it. You're definitely bringing the drama, you know, from both pieces. We only have 2 minutes left, and I want to get to the third one that you sent. This one is Tchaikovsky 1812 Overture.
It's a curious quirk of independent stage July 4 programs that, you know, for decades and decades, we've ended after a bunch of, Americana with Philip Sousa marches and everything. We'll often end with the 1812 Overture because its thematic content is really all about victory over oppression, which is a universal concept. And so it's a great way to end this blockbuster concert. And we really hope people will come out to celebrate the opening of the 97th season of the Stockton Symphony. And I really wanted to bring Scott here today because we're so delighted that he's here, this new CEO, and we're just so delighted he's here. I hope people can come out and meet him.
Thank you so much, Scott. It was great meeting you.
Hey, nice meeting you too.
And that is Peter Jaffe, the music director and conductor of the Stockton Symphony, joined by the new CEO, Scott Watkins, ahead of the season opener, which kicks off this weekend. And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, shoot us an email, insight@capradio.org. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day. We will catch you back here tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.